call JLE Express if you're staying longer. I thought Express kind of... Anyway, I don't even understand the title.
You're teaching us more faster.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got to know.
This is only 15 minutes.
Oh, okay, that's it. Speed learning. That's good. So anyway, I think that this is a little bit of maybe more detail than more of the general classes. And the assignment I was given, and again, I'm happy to take questions about everything. Not that I'm going to answer it, but at least you know you're free to bring up things, is really to go through some very important aspects of the Jewish life cycle. So Judaism is not just a religion, it's really a life. And all of the pivotal events of life are covered by the Torah. So things like marriage, things like divorce, birth of children, circumcision, and daily rituals like the tzitzis and the tefillin and what they represent, and how you can incorporate it into your life. I think that, you know, there are a lot of things in the Torah that we might not understand. For example, why can't you wear wool and linen? You know, these are things that can bother us. But there are a lot of stuff that, you know, makes sense. If the Torah talks about loving relationships, and, you know, that's the only time I got angry at a JLE person, not this session, is, you know, some people get in such a mindset that they want to say, what's the reason that God cares? All right, so people will say, you know, why does God care about Shabbos? Why does God care about kosher? Right, those are questions, right? So at one point I was talking about how God wants us to love each other. So the guy's like in such an automatic pilot. Why does God care if people love each other? So at that point I lost it really for the first time in my career, basically. And I said, if you don't understand that, you know, then there's nothing to talk about. So I think everybody understands instinctively that a world in which there's love and care is just a better world than a world where there's not love and care. And a lot of Judaism is based on that. Now, that's not going to explain wool and linen. I understand that. Though when we come to marriage, you know, that's kind of it. There is a very important idea. I think I may have mentioned this, but I'll repeat it quickly. Remember the biblical book of the Song of Songs. Now, the Song of Songs almost didn't make it. It almost got banned in Boston when the rabbis were deciding what should be a holy book as part of the Bible and what should be a secular book that's excluded. And in those days, by the way, a secular book was not just secular, it was actually banned. You couldn't read it. The rabbis had rules about secular books, even stricter than perhaps the rabbis in Or Sameach. And the rabbis actually many rabbis wanted to consider the Song of Songs to be a secular, semi-pornographic love song. Have you ever looked at the Song of Songs? It talks about kissing and ravishing, and there are quite a few euphemisms for intercourse, although it's a bit delicate in that way. But, you know, it's talking about sex and all the different things. And the rabbi said, hey, this is a drinking song. This is something that you say in a bar. This is something that, you know, it's obscene. Why do you have it in the Bible? But the great Rabbi Akiva came up with the understanding that the Song of Songs is a metaphor. It is not meant to refer exclusively and literally to the man-woman relationship, but it is a metaphor, an allegory, for the relationship of the Jewish people to God. God is described as the king or the prince, and the Jewish people is described as the woman that is yearning and pining to be reunited with her lover. And a lot of the narrative is kind of a Romeo and Juliet type of story in which the lovers meet in the middle of the night, or they meet at the break of dawn, and then they have to separate. And then the lover comes looking for his beloved, and he knocks on her door, and she wants to play hard to get. So she says, I've taken off my shoes, I've retired for the night, come back later, hoping that he'll keep on knocking or whatever it is, but he leaves. And all of this is a metaphor for the idea that God yearns to redeem us, and we're not ready. And when we're finally ready, God's not ready. And this tragic near miss that happens over and over again, the dynamic dance of Jewish history, that there are so many times Hashem is ready to give us blessings. Rav Soloveitchik, the great Rav Soloveitchik, wrote a beautiful, beautiful essay about Zionism and the return to Israel. Now, because the refrain in the Song of Songs is, the voice of my beloved is knocking at the door. This is a phrase you may even want to memorize the Hebrew. Kol dodi dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking at the door. So he wrote a whole essay that the establishment of the State of Israel was God knocking at the door, calling us to come to Him, to come back to Him, to come back to His land, and by extension, to reconnect to God. And how many of us are deaf to that call? And when we finally get ready, you know, maybe God is not ready for us at that point. Right? So the Song of Songs, Rabbi Akiva taught, if all of the songs of the Bible are holy, the Song of Songs is holy of holy. You may notice, perhaps if you look at a sitter, that many people, Hasidim and the like, although it's not our custom, but it might as well be, it's a beautiful custom, they actually read the Song of Songs every Friday afternoon before the Shabbat, because as they enter into the unique relationship of love that we have in Shabbat, they want to capture the romantic fervor that is seen in the Song of Songs. Many people read it, if you're still up, after four cups of wine, not so easy. Mm-hmm. Many people read the Song of Songs after the Passover Seder. Because, once again, the exodus of the Jews from Egypt was an act of divine love. Yeah, did you want to say something?
I have two questions. So yes, Song of Songs, I think you mentioned it's from the actual...
Oh, it's in the Bible, yes, in the Tanakh, yeah. Okay, maybe I'm a little confusing here. When I say Bible, maybe I shouldn't use the word Bible. The Jewish Bible, what is called by Christians the Old Testament, has three parts to it. There is Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. Torah are the five books of Moses, and that is what is the Torah scroll in the Ark. That is called Torah. And that is the ultimate, that is the highest authority that was given by God to Moses. That has the 613 commandments. That is Torah. That's not the same as Bible. Torah is the first five books of the Jewish Bible, called Torah. Now, after Torah, we have books of great sanctity, but they're lesser sanctity. These are called the books of the prophets. They are after Moshe. They are called Nevi'im, prophets. And they include, just to mention them, Yehoshua, Joshua, who is, of course, Moses' successor, Judges, Kings, Samuel, Kings, these are books of history, and then the great prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then what are called erroneously the minor prophets. They're not minor, they're major prophets, but they're smaller books that are called minor prophets. This includes the story of Jonah and the whale, Hosea, Joel, that's called prophets, Nevi'im. And then you have what are called assorted writings, such as Psalms, Proverbs, the story of Esther. So each is given a name. The five books of Moses is called Torah. The prophetic books are called Nevi'im, prophets. And the assorted writings are called Kisuvim. And if you take the first letter of those three terms, Torah is Tuf, Nun is Nevi'im, Chaf is Kisuvim, it spells Tanakh. So the Jewish Bible is called Tanakh, which is an abbreviation, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. So when I say Shir HaShirim is part of the Bible, I mean it is part of the Ketuvim. It is part of the sacred writings in part 3. It is not part of the Torah. The Torah is only the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. That was question one. Now question two?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Rabbi Akiva, you said he's the one that did the interpretation and said this is a metaphor.
Yep.
What's his credibility? Who is he? Is he a prophet?
Oh, okay. I love when you give me a chance to talk about biographies, because I really like biographies.
Sorry,
Rabbi Akiva, now thank you for asking. I planted the question. Rabbi Akiva is one of the greatest of all the rabbis in Talmudic literature. He died a martyr's death. He lived after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Romans destroyed the Second Temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. Rabbi Akiva lived around that time, and he survived until the Bar Kokhba revolt. That was our Custer's last stand in the year 135. And he died a martyr's death, being tortured to death because of his adherence to Torah. Rabbi Akiva is one of the few romantic stories in Talmudic literature. The Talmud is not overtly romantic document, but Rabbi Akiva was said to be an ignorant shepherd. He was unlearned, he knew nothing, but he was in the employ of one of the wealthiest landowners of Jerusalem, a man that was called Kalba Savua, which is a very interesting name. Kalva Savua is Aramaic. It means a satiated dog, a dog that is full. Why would a man be called a dog that was full? It sounds like an insult.
Is feminine, is it not?
Well, in Hebrew that's true, but in Aramaic is kind of like Pig Latin. Just add an awe to every word. So Kelev in Hebrew, Kalba is, you know, is Aramaic, and the like. You are correct. A Kalba with a hay in Ivrit would be a female dog. Okay, so he was called a satiated dog because it really was a compliment to his great hospitality. He was so generous in his hospitality that if you walked into his house starving, you would walk out like a dog that's full. Now, dogs never get full. Dogs can eat forever and ever. So if even the dog is full, that means his hospitality was very generous. So it's a compliment, not an insult. But be it as it may, he was a very, very wealthy man. And Rabbi Akiva was in his employ as a shepherd. And he was ignorant. He didn't know how to read Hebrew. He was an ignoramus. Many Jews were not literate in those days. Well, I guess things haven't changed. Many Jews are not literate in Hebrew even today. But what happened was the boss's daughter fell in love with him. The boss's daughter, her name was Rachel, and she saw in him qualities of gentleness. She saw intelligence. She saw something in him that perhaps he didn't even see in himself. And she fell in love with him, and she wanted to marry him. Her father was enraged. How dare you marry the hired hand? How dare you marry this ignoramus? I could get you the biggest rabbis or the best businessmen or whatever. I mean, he wasn't rich either. Rabbi Akiva didn't have money. He didn't have education. He was unlettered. He was uncultured. So her father was enraged. She did marry him. The father disinherited her. And she lived in abject poverty with Rabbi Akiva. He was not rabbi then, by the way, he was just Akiva. But she encouraged him to go to Jerusalem and study Torah. And he said, what do you mean study Torah? I don't know how to read. He says, okay, you'll start. He was 40 years old when he got married. 40 years old. Much older than anybody, other than present company accepted. And he came to Jerusalem. And she inspired him. And she encouraged him. And he literally started with what we would call the first graders. He simply, learned how to read Aleph Beis. And when there were times that he was discouraged, he would take walks. And he once noticed how water was dripping on a rock, drop after drop after drop. And over a long period of time, it made a hole in the rock. So Rabbi Akiva said, Torah, he had heard, is compared to water. And my brain is like a rock, things don't go through. But after a while, the water penetrates the rock. He says, maybe the Torah is going to penetrate me. And he stayed for 12 years. He was not even home that often. He stayed for 12 years. And after 12 years, he came home to be with his wife, and he overhears his wife having a conversation with the neighbors. Now, she's living in poverty for this whole period of time. And a neighbor is telling her, what type of bum of a husband do you have? Not only does he reduce you to poverty, but he doesn't even stay home. He's away in Jerusalem all the time. And she said, I wouldn't mind if he'd go back for another 12 years. And he didn't even say hello. He just turned back and went back to Jerusalem. And he stayed for another 12 years, 24 years of Torah study. So now he's 64 years old, not a young man. But by this time, he became the greatest of rabbis in Israel. After those 24 years, he had thousands and thousands of disciples, of students. 24,000 students. And he came back with a huge, huge entourage. And his wife, who was in rags, comes to greet him, and they think she's a crazy woman, the students are the handlers, and they push her away. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, no, no. Everything I am and everything you are is only because of her. Now, his father-in-law didn't know this was his son-in-law. He didn't know this was the ignorant shepherd that had abandoned his daughter. But he felt bad that his daughter, after 24 years, he feels bad that his daughter was suffering so much. But he made a vow. He disinherited her. So he hears this great rabbi is coming to town, who maybe could find him a way to get out of the vow. So he goes over to the great rabbi and says, you know, I was angry many, many years ago, and I made a vow that my daughter will get nothing. Is there a way I could get out of this vow? So this rabbi, who Kabbalah Sfor doesn't even know, said to him, well, let me ask you this question. If you would have known that your son-in-law would become a Talmid Chacham, a scholar, would you have made the vow under those circumstances? Because there is a rule in halacha. If I make a vow based on what I think is going to be the situation, but the situation changes, that is a basis for annulment, because had I known the outcome, I wouldn't have made the vow. Now, you understand the concept. So Rabbi Akiva said to him, so Kabbalah Sfor said, a Talmud Chacham, he didn't have to be a Talmud Chacham. If I would have known he would be literate, I wouldn't have made the vow. Rabbi Akiva told him, okay, your vow is released. And from that point onwards, of course, Rabbi Akiva became known as the greatest of the rabbis. In fact, at that point, you know, the wealth came through, and they were able to live the rest of their lives. They were able to live comfortably and the like. So with Rabbi Akiva, we see a lot of lessons. We, of course, see the idea that it's never too late to start. They tell this very cute story. You know, have you guys heard of Shlomo Carlbach? Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach? Shlomo Carlbach is a bit of a controversial figure. He's not alive anymore. He's really one of the greatest of Jewish folk singers. Like, a lot of the songs that we sing come from Carlbach. Now, he himself started off as a conventional rabbi. He was actually very learned, but eventually, you know, he became primarily a folk singer, and then he got into not the drug culture. He's not in the drug culture, but he was kind of like a hippie-ish type of rabbi. Yeah, kind of hugging the women. So there were certain controversial aspects of Carlbach that maybe the yeshiva community doesn't like so much. But he was a real sweet man, and I have to say that whatever infractions of halacha he committed, and he did commit some. I can't whitewash it totally, but it really came from a very, very loving heart, a very caring heart. In fact, they tell a story about, again, forgive me for digressing, but they think the digressions are interesting too. This is already a digression from a digression, so I have to remember to get back. The story goes that one of his students was once traveling through a bad neighborhood in Brooklyn, and his car broke down. That's everybody's nightmare, when your car breaks down in a dangerous neighborhood, you know, just breaks down. So of course, there's kind of a gang that walks by. You know the way the gangs are. They act as if they want to help you. Let's get present. Is there a problem over here? Maybe we can help you. But you know what's coming down the pike. This was a black gang, although that's not that important. But they jump him. They take his wallet. They start beating him. And as they go through the wallet, there's a picture of Shlomo Carlbach. Just a picture. So the gang leader says, wait a minute, guys. And they go to the gang leader goes to the Jewish guy and says, you know this person here? He says, yes, you know, this is my rabbi. He says, okay, guys, leave him alone. He's a friend of the rabbi. You know, so apparently, Carlbach even helped out this guy, you know, in some way. You know, so that saved his life. You know, they got his car fixed, and they got him a cab, and you know, whatever it is, and everything was everything worked out well, because Carlbach was really a lover of humanity and the like. So the story goes that once he was invited to officiate at a wedding, and it was kind of on a mountaintop, some really, really crazy location. And he was not the most punctual person, because he was a creative person, an absent-minded person. So he showed up like 2 hours late for the wedding. And the bride's father is very upset and says to Carlbach, he says, you are very late. So Rav Carlbach puts his hand on his shoulder, gives him a big smile, and says, it's never too late. You know, and that's kind of one of the messages of Rabbi Akiva, and it's a great message. It's a message that we need to hear, because, you know, people feel sometimes, oh, I start my connection to Judaism so late. What could I ever become? Could I ever become learned in the Torah? Could I even become a rabbi? Could I become a teacher? The story of Rabbi Akiva is very, very inspiring. That no matter how old you are, you know, you can go back to it. You know, you can connect. You can become great. Now, I'm not going to promise anybody that, you know, anyone here will be Rabbi Akiva, including myself, that we could ever be Rabbi Akiva, even with 24 years of Torah study. But if we can't be Rabbi Akiva, we could become, you know, very significant. That's one lesson. The other lesson of Rabbi Akiva's life is really the devotion of a wife who sees the greatness in her husband, and vice versa, husband seeing it in his wife, even though they don't see it in themselves. True love is not just infatuation. It's seeing the goodness and the potential in the other person. And that is really the sign of a great teacher, in which he helps you see your potential. And that is the sign of a great spouse. That spouse, and again, that's not just wife to husband, it's also husband to wife. That you see the potential in a person and you help them realize it, as opposed to dragging somebody down. And she made a lot of sacrifices. But let me point out, Rabbi Akiva did not unilaterally put these sacrifices on her. This is what she wanted. And it's only because it's what she wanted that Akiva pursued it. Otherwise, he would not have pursued it. So you see beautiful lessons in marriage as well. And you see also the idea of a very important idea of deferred gratification, that instead of looking for short-term pleasures, you kind of understand no pain, no gain, that sometimes you've got to invest in the long haul. So this is my biographical digression about Rabbi Akiva. But once again, his interpretations carry great, great, great weight. In fact, he was so esteemed that there's a Talmudic tradition that is recorded that when God gave the Torah to Moses, and Moses is in heaven, God is showing him all of the future generations. And as Moses gets a vision of the future generations, he hears this rabbi expounding the Torah with such clarity and such genius that Moshe himself can't always follow. He says, gee, Rabbi Akiva was surpassing even Moshe. And Moshe then said, I want to see the great reward of this great rabbi. So God shows him Rabbi Akiva being tortured to death. And Moses says, this is the Torah that he teaches, and this is the reward that he gets? And God says, don't ask questions. That's the way it is. Remember, we talked briefly about the idea that why the righteous suffer is a profoundly difficult question. And we don't always have an answer to that. There are things in this world we don't understand. Rabbi Akiva did die a martyr's death, but there's a beautiful story even then. Rabbi Akiva is being tortured. It's even described that the Romans took iron hooks and they were flaying his flesh, his skin, and his muscle from him with iron hooks. So he didn't die right away. He was going through this excruciating agony. And his students actually spoke to him as he was going through this. And they said, how could God do this to you? A real question that we would feel. And listen to what Rabbi Akiva said. All of my life, or at least since I became a religious Jew, I've been saying the verse that you must love the Lord your God with all of your heart and all of your soul and all of your might. And all of your soul means even if you have to give up your life for God, you do it. All of my life I said this verse. And now the Almighty has given me the opportunity to fulfill it. I rejoice in the opportunity that God has given me. Can you imagine such a thing? In the agonies of death, he rejoices. Lahavdil, not that I want to compare it, but you may remember from your grade school days, or maybe college if you studied American history, Nathan Hale, right? Nathan Hale was a patriot who was hung by the British, and his last words were, I regret that I have but one life to give to my country. That he actually was proud and elevated to give up his life for his country. Rabbi Akiva, again, I don't mean to compare it exactly, but Rabbi Akiva made the same point. It is a privilege for me to die for the glory of God. And that is the fulfillment of serving God with all of my heart, with all of my soul, with all of my might. Again, just to be sure people, I forgive me for the digressions, but I think all Torah knowledge is good. I just want to be sure you understand a little bit of the historical background here. You understand that the Romans were occupying what was called Palestine, and for many, many years we were just an occupied country, and Jews were able to learn Torah, do mitzvahs, we had a temple, meaning the Romans didn't conquer and then destroy the temple right away. I mean, for decades, for more than 100 years, we were simply under Roman occupation, but we were able to do our thing. I mean, there were taxes, I mean, obviously there were difficulties, but it's not like as soon as the Romans conquered us, they destroyed the temple. But what happened was that the Jews themselves precipitated a rebellion against Rome, and the sages weren't in favor of it. The sages were not in favor of a revolutionary war against Rome, because they told the so-called zealots, you're going to lose this war, and things are going to be a lot worse for the Jewish people. So the rabbis were actually relatively pacifistic here, and they basically said, let us remain under Roman rule, and we'll be able to have our temple and serve God. But the zealots precipitated rebellion against the advice of the sages, and as a result the Romans entered into a very, very bitter war against the Jews that lasted for almost 10 years, culminating in the destruction of the temple and the exile of Jews from Jerusalem, and really thousands of Jews being murdered, sold into slavery, women being raped, and the like. Now, this occurred in the year 70, 1668 and 70, but 70 is the standard date that we use. And now, the Jews were not exiled from Israel. They still were allowed to live in Israel. And in fact, they were even allowed to keep the Torah. The anti-Semitic, anti-Torah legislation did not come after the destruction of the temple. But we lost the temple. That was a biggie. And thousands of Jews were killed. That's correct, that's correct. At that point, we were allowed to keep the Torah, because the temple was not destroyed. If you analyze historically, the temple was not destroyed as an anti-religious act. The temple was destroyed as a way of crushing a Jewish rebellion of which the sages did not approve. Now, the actual Roman general who was in charge of destroying the temple was a man called Titus, or in Hebrew, Titus. And Titus later became emperor of Rome shortly after the destruction of the temple. And he erected in Rome a triumphal arch to commemorate his subjugation of the province of Judea, which was part of, it was called Judea, then it was not called Palestine. Palestine comes later. Judea means the kingdom of the Jews. And if you look at the top of the Arch of Titus, you actually see pictures, bas relief, of Jews being led in chains, carrying the menorah, right? You've seen that picture. That is a picture from the time of the destruction of the temple itself. That is our best historical reconstruction of what the menorah actually looked like. In fact, it's interesting, apparently over the course of years, originally the bas relief was apparently in color, and the color faded. There's actually a project right now that is trying to restore the original colors, and apparently it's very, very beautiful. But you know, there's an old Jewish tradition that a Jew that is in Rome does not walk under the triumphal arch of Titus, because you don't want to glorify, you don't want to give any type of glory or credit to a symbol of the subjugation of the Jews. On the other hand, people tell me that some people have walked under the arch, like in the middle of the night, and they put some graffiti there to the effect of Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people still live, where's Titus, you know, things like that. So I'm not going to tell you one way or the other. Either don't walk under the arch, or walk under it and deface it. So you can do either of those options is halachically acceptable.
I would think. Graffiti in Hebrew or in Latin?
Well, I would say maybe Italian people should understand it. I'm not sure if they'll get the Latin. In fact, they once had this in a bathroom, although this is, you're not supposed to do this in a bathroom. Somebody wrote, "God is dead, Nietzsche." So somebody wrote under that, "Nietzsche is dead, God." kind of that thing going on. Now, let me point out, though, that the Jews gave the Romans a real run for the money. The number of years it took Rome to squelch the rebellion in Judea was the longest single continuous series of battles that the Roman Empire had. Much harder than in Gaul and in Britain and the like. This was a campaign that, in fact, Rome was very shocked that they had to devote so many resources to fighting this insignificant little Jewish people. So we were quite difficult. And, all right, so what happened was this. So that's the year 70. Now, flash forward to around 130, 60 years later, there was a man. His name was Shimon ben Kuziva. And he began to organize the Jews for a second revolt. Imagine this. The revolt was mercilessly crushed in 70 with the destruction of the temple. And the Jews are now coming back 60 years later. And Rabbi Akiva, who was alive then, actually believed that this man was Mashiach. And he gave him a new name. His name was Shimon ben Kuziva. Rabbi Akiva called him Bar Kokhba. Now, Bar Kokhba is Aramaic for the son of a star. Again, Kochav, Kokhba, you see the Aramaic pattern of adding the Aleph sound at the end. Why did Rabbi Akiva call him the son of a star? Because in last week's Torah reading, when the prophet Bilam talks about the future, he refers to a star coming out of Jacob, and that was understood as Mashiach, a messianic prediction. And Rabbi Akiva viewed Bar Kokhba as a potential Mashiach, and that's why he called him, "You are the star that will redeem and liberate the Jewish people." Now, some of Rabbi Akiva's colleagues were very skeptical. Someone told Rabbi Akiva, "Akiva," calling him by the first name, "there will be grass growing out of your hand," meaning you'll be in the grave a very long time, "before Mashiach comes." But Rabbi Akiva put his credence on Bar Kokhba. And Bar Kokhba initially was remarkably successful. In the course of several years, he regained custody of 900 Jewish villages to establish an independent Jewish state. People proclaimed him as king. He actually minted coins. You can get Bar Kokhba coins. They're not that expensive. You can actually get some coins minted from the Bar Kokhba period. And there's even archaeological evidence that under the guidance of Rabbi Akiva, they began to construct a third temple. They began. They never finished it. They began to construct a third temple. But eventually, the Emperor Hadrian retaliated with overwhelming force. He was no longer going to be Mr. Nice Guy. And this culminated in a massive battle in the city of Beitar, which is not where modern Beitar is, but Beitar is on the Mediterranean coast. And the casualties and the massacres of Beitar were even greater than the destruction of the temple 70 years earlier. And Hadrian initiated a series of extreme persecutions after Bar Kokhba. So the extreme persecutions of which I'm going to describe were not in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple. They were in the aftermath of the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135, 5 years later. And that is where Rabbi Akiva was tortured and died a martyr's death because of his participation in the Bar Kokhba revolt. Well, the minor thing that he did is he renamed the country. It was no longer called Judea. It was called Palestina, Palestine. Now, what is Palestine? It's a nonsensical name. Palestine is the land of the Philistines. Now, the Philistines were an ancient people that were long extinct. Already in Roman times, they were gone. There were no Philistines even then. But he wanted to emotionally sever the connection of the Jewish people to the land. It's not the land of the Jews, it's the land of the Philistines. All right, I mean, that probably didn't make a big difference, but as you know, it remains Palestine until 1948. That name stuck. And the Palestinian people is a total myth. There are no Palestinian people. They were invented in 1967, essentially. Palestinian people are either Jordanian Arabs or from somewhere else. I mean, Arafat was from Egypt and the like. Okay, now here's the thing. Hadrian prohibited Jews from living in Jerusalem. He turned the city of Jerusalem into an idolatrous shrine to Jupiter, and he renamed it Ilia Capitolina. And Jews were not allowed. It became Judenrein. This is the only time, except for the years between 48 and 67, that no Jews were allowed to live in Jerusalem. It became dedicated as a temple to Jupiter. The whole city was plowed over. And there is a bit of a remnant to this. You know, have you been in the old city? There's an area called the Cardo. And the Cardo is actually the Roman marketplace. It's much lower than the present street level. Now it's a fancy mall, but still a shopping place. It is the Roman marketplace from the time of Ilia Capitolina, when Jews were not allowed to be in Jerusalem. And the only thing that was allowed is every ninth of Av, Jews were allowed to circle the walls of the city from the outside, kind of to rub salt in their wounds. And to this very day, some people have, depending on the safety, it's not always safe, but there is a custom that many people have, or had, on the ninth of Av, they walk around the walls of the old city, either on top of the walls, which you really cannot do because you cannot do a 360 circuit. I mean, you can walk and then you got to get down and get up again. But ideally, around those or from ground level, they walk around the walls of the old city. And Hadrian also enacted, in other words, when the Talmud talks about all these laws that Jews weren't allowed to learn Torah and Jews couldn't practice circumcision, all of this is not from the time of the destruction of the temple. It is from the aftermath of Bar Kokhba. So what's fascinating politically is that Rabbi Akiva was much more militant than the sages of the previous generation. I mean, I hope you can see there was a shift in perspective here, because I told you that the sages of the previous generation were absolutely against the precipitation of a military conflict with Rome, because they basically felt that this is hopeless. God is not going to do a supernatural miracle for us. It is better to remain under Roman domination, where we have the temple and we can study Torah, than to try to engage in a war in which the likelihood of failure is overwhelming. The sages at the time of the destruction of the temple, particularly Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, adopted what you might call a pacifistic stance. Now, I don't mean pacifistic in principle, but pacifistic pragmatically. That pragmatically, it didn't make sense to precipitate a war. We'll call this situational pacifism. It may be a made-up phrase, but we could use it. On the other hand, and to me it's very fascinating, Rabbi Akiva had a very different political philosophy based on his understanding of the Torah, that he basically said, now maybe he felt since the temple was already destroyed, we don't have a lot to lose. On the other hand, that turned out to be wrong, because there was a lot that we lost. I mean, we lost the ability to study Torah and the like. But it is fascinating, Rabbi Akiva was an active, he was very old, so he was not a soldier per se, but he was a very, very active spiritual force in the Bar Kokhba revolt. Again, I don't know what to make of this difference in views, other than noting that, to me, it's always a little fascinating. We tend to think of rabbis as kind of ivory tower people. And many of us are, actually. You know, we sit and we learn and we teach. But you see that the rabbis then were quite involved in the very volatile politics and wars of the time, either counseling restraint or counseling active intervention. So this was not an ivory tower. It's amazing. Rabbi Akiva taught so much Torah and thousands of students, but he was still deeply involved in these issues. Yeah.
So was the army itself, sorry if this is sidetracking, was Bar Kokhba's army religious? Was it a halakhic army?
Yeah, well, once again, we have to assume it was a halachic army simply because Rabbi Akiva was their halachic authority.
Okay.
Now, was every single soldier religious? No, I can't tell you. Not every Jew was religious. A majority of the Jews were religious. A majority of the Jews kept, certainly, Shabbat, Kashrut. This was something that was noticed by the Greeks and the Romans of the time. You can look at contemporary accounts. No Jew, I mean, they would say, Jews don't do work on Shabbat. So the basics were widely, widely, widely kept, but...
So they wouldn't fight on Shabbat?
Well, this is a very interesting point. There was an ancient Jewish tradition dating much earlier than this, dating to the Maccabean struggles, which were 200 years earlier, that they did not fight on Shabbat unless they're being attacked. Now remember the halakha. Halakha does say to preserve your life, you desecrate Shabbat. If there's an enemy that is attacking me and would massacre me unless I fight back, I do fight on Shabbat. But we don't do any war of aggression or offense. We would not attack a target on Shabbat, even if it would create surprise and the like. But we could fight, and this is true even today, obviously. We have religious, I mean, not every soldier is religious, it's true. But even a religious soldier will certainly fight on Shabbat if it's a defensive mission. Okay, so this, yeah.
When did the term Philistine begin to refer to someone who's devoid of culture?
Yeah, that's very interesting because again, Philistine was an actual nation, right? There was a nation that lived on the Mediterranean coast. Some say the origin of the Philistines is actually from Crete, and in ancient times they migrated to the Mediterranean coast and conquered the coastal cities. And they were very, very fierce. In fact, let me just point out, when we left Egypt, the Torah itself says this in the book of Exodus, the easiest way to go from Egypt to Israel, is to go up the Mediterranean coast. Instead of going into the desert and crossing the Red Sea, and then crossing from the east side of Jordan. So why didn't God take us the direct route up the Mediterranean coast? The Torah says... because that was the land of the Philistines. And they were so fierce that it would have scared us. We would have run back to Egypt. As it were, we were complaining. So the one thing you see, that the Philistines were there a long time. They were there before we were there. And number two, you see they were very, very fierce warriors. Now, I'm going to check when it happened. But the reason why there was an association with kind of ignorance and lack of culture was based on perhaps the stereotype that the fierce warrior is almost like a wild animal, uncontrollable, unrestrained. So that became almost the synonym for the person that is so barbaric that all they know is violence. But the actual time, I'm going to have to check to see when it first became any popular term for an old uncultured person. But you are correct. We do talk about uncultured people as being Philistines. Again, in Hebrew, it's Palishtim. Palishtim. Okay. Now, all of this was a digression to the main point, which I'm going to save, I guess, for the next time we meet. And that is, I was just trying to... how did I get onto this? Let's see if I remember. But the way... Right, we got onto this because I was trying to talk about Song of Songs. And Song of Songs was dismissed by many rabbis as pornographic or romantic literature at best. It was Rabbi Akiva that saved the Song of Songs by describing it as a metaphor or an allegory. And then we digressed in discussing Rabbi Akiva and in discussing some of the history of the time. But we're going to move back. And I do want to focus, because since we're talking about marriage and relationships once again, on why Rabbi Akiva's insight into Shir HaShirim is so important for marriage and relationships, right? That's kind of right. So a lot of this was filler to give you the supplementary knowledge to put things in perspective. But next time we will go back to the Song of Songs, which will lead us back into a discussion of marriage once again. Yeah, final question.
What is Shir HaShirim?
Song
of
Songs. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And two, what's the problem with so the Rabbi Akiva is studying, why can't he just go back home? Isn't this a sort of balance? Why is he gone for 12 years, come back for second gone for the next 12 years?
Yeah, well, this is a difficult situation. I certainly would not recommend it for any of us. But there was this notion of total immersion. And that is, you know, you kind of learn a little bit and play a little bit. Rabbi Akiva needed to be in an environment of being totally immersed. Now, this was an extreme, to be sure. But the concept of total immersion on some level is a very important idea. That is, let me give you a mashal. I'll end with this mashal as a parable. Let's imagine it would take 20 minutes for a pot of water to come to a boil, cold water to come to a boil. 20 minutes on the fire, it comes to a boil. Now, if I leave it on the fire continuously, it'll come to a boil in 20 minutes. But let's say after every 19 and a half minutes, I shut off the water, I shut off the fire, and I let the water cool down, and then I turn it on again for another 19 and a half minutes, do the same thing. So you'd be wondering, gee, I've had it on the fire for 5 hours already, 19 and a half minutes, why isn't it boiling? The answer is, if you don't have the critical mass of continuity, it's not going to be the same. So if you learn, take off, 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 even if you wind up learning for 24 years, if it's spread over 50 years, it's not the same as critical mass. And that's the story of the Akiva, that's the Akiva story. Now, that has some practical repercussions for us as well. Not in the sense that anyone's asking you to lock yourself in Or Sameach for 24 years. But there is an idea that if you have a chance to study Torah, let's say for 6 months straight, or a year straight, that's very different than doing a little bit at a time and kind of breaking it up, because you're not going to get a critical mass. There is something to continuity that is not replicated by simply having the same amount of learning time spread over a longer period. So there is a lesson in the Akiva story for how we should structure our own spiritual lives as well. Okay, see you. Actually, tomorrow, unfortunately, I'm not going to be. I think our next meeting is going to be Thursday at the same time. Okay, you take care.